So, we have an interesting story tonight. The stories of the Parsha can be understood on many different levels. There's the plain story, the drama. We saw last week the drama of how they, Bilam the prophet and Balak the king wanted to destroy the Jews, and how that played out in terms of the way that God runs the universe, free will and destiny. So we took it on a sort of philosophical angle to the Parsha. Today, we'll start at the surface. Generally, there are four layers of meaning in the Torah. We call it the orchard. Orchard stands for four words: Pshat, Remez, Drush, Soid. Plain meaning of the text, Remez, hints and allusions, Drush, searching for deeper meaning, and Soid is the esoteric, the secrets. And if you take the first letter of each one of those words, spells Pardes, the word for orchard. So strolling, taking a stroll in the orchard of Torah, is to start from the surface, go beneath the surface, and keep going till you get to the bottom layer, which is the sod, which is the esoteric, the mystical, the secrets. And of course, the Torah's got infinite layers like that. So we stopped at the philosophical last time. Today we're going to go a little bit further. So we're going to go down to the sod, look at some of the mystical, Kabbalistic meaning behind the story, because the Torah makes sense on every level. On the level of Pshat, the plain meaning of the text, that's a whole separate discipline. The what we call the Drush and Soid, the deeper meaning as elaborated in the Talmud and the Medrash, and then the Sod is the secret meaning as found in the Kabbalah. And they're all complementary. And in fact, one of the ways it works is that when you're at any level of understanding, any layer of meaning of the text, when you don't fully comprehend it, when you get stuck, when you get to a dead end, you go to the next level and suddenly it comes clear. So ultimately, most of the questions, all the puzzles of the text of the Torah can be resolved by looking into the Kabbalah, looking into this deepest level, the secrets of the Torah. And that's kind of what we're going to do this week. So we'll start simple, then we'll get a little mystical at the end. Okay? So, put your seatbelts on. If you feel yourself, your body rising. So we'll start with the simple story and then we'll move a little bit on to the mystical. Okay, we've got somebody here, I don't know. What's the name there? Somebody. Ben K. No idea. Oh, Shalom Ben. Shalom Ben, L'chaim. So that was the intro. So we're going to go to the text because there's a lot of text to cover. In order to get to the mystical part, like I said, the approach we're going to take today, we're going to study the plain surface meaning of the text, and there are a lot of questions, and then we're going to kind of jump into the esoteric, into the Kabbalah, the mystical area of the Torah, layer of meaning. And that's going to help us understand all of the supposed questions in the narrative, in the story. So that's what we're planning to do. Okay, I don't know what there was a message there. What is it saying? I'm going to listen. Oh, no problem. Very good. Excellent. Okay, so we're going to go to the text. Okay. So I'll go through the text, and then by the end, we'll open it up to questions. So if anyone has questions, that was, why did I do that? 1 second. If anyone has questions, make a note. Okay, what did I do? I just shut it. Let me find it. Is that it? Yeah, got it. Okay. Press the wrong button. Okay. So here's the setup of the story. The Jews have been traveling for 40 years in the desert. They approached civilization. And you recall last week, as they're on the outskirts of civilization, they encounter a couple of countries outside of Israel. Their destination is Israel, land of Canaan. They're going to cross the Jordan, and they'll be embarking on a campaign of conquest. For those who don't want to make peace, those who don't want to evacuate, those who decide to remain and declare war, then there'll be a military campaign of conquest. Along the way, if you remember, it was part of the drama of last week's story. They had asked peacefully for passage through the land of the Amorites and the land of the king of Bashan. Peaceful. We'll pay for the water. We'll stick to the main road, etc., etc. And the two kings had refused. They were on the other side of the Jordan, Transjordan. And I guess you call that the east side of the Jordan. And they attacked the Jews, men, women, and children, civilians. And the Jews, of course, defended themselves. And they actually completely annihilated these two kings. And they were very powerful kings. We learned last week, they were the mercenaries protecting the border. They were paid a tribute by all the kings of Canaan to protect the border. Don't let anybody through. They were the muscle, the hired guns. And the Jews took them out, which is what caused the whole panic last week. And this is the continuation. And what happened is, now the Jews came into possession of all this land, all this territory that was not Israel proper. Okay? It's not Israel proper because it's the other side of the Jordan. It's Transjordan. And the question is, what's the status of this land? So what happens is that there are two tribes, Gad and Reuben. You know, 12. So these are the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad. They approach Moses and they make a request. So look, it's divine providence. They attacked us. We conquered them. Now we have all this land available to us, all this territory. And we think it's a great shidduch. It's a great match. It's just what the doctor ordered for our two tribes. Why were they thinking this? We'll see in a moment. And Moses' reaction to their request, basically what they're saying is, we're not going to cross over the Jordan. We're staying here. We like it here. Great land. It's perfect. We'll settle here. You go with the 10 tribes into the land of Israel, and we'll settle here. So we'll see what is motivating them, what appears to be motivating them, and what is in fact motivating them. We'll delve deeper later on. And we'll see Moses' reaction. And what's going to puzzle us is that Moses' initial reaction is one thing, and then he seems to do a 360 turn. First, he's terribly opposed, and suddenly he's all for it. Not only that, he expands on their original suggestion. Let's take a look. Numbers chapter 32. Okay, so the sons of Reuben and Gad, they had a lot of cattle, a lot of livestock. How they had livestock and why so much, it's a whole separate story, but turns out that of all the tribes, they had the largest possession of livestock. Okay, so they need a lot of land for grazing, for sheep, for cattle. So they look around at the land of Yazer and Gilad, and that's the land in the Transjordan, east of the, across the Jordan, before you enter the Holy Land, and Gilad, and the place is perfect for livestock. A lot of grass, perfect grazing territory. So they say, oh, it's great shidduch. So the sons of Gad and Reuben, they speak to Moses, and they say, look, this is a perfect match. Why do we need to go into the land of Israel and proper, the Holy Land, and take our chances? We like what we see. Big, wide open spaces, lots of grass. We need grazing for our huge quantities of livestock. We're happy if you leave us right here. Let's see if Moshe's happy with them. So they explain, you know, they have, this is their suggestion, their proposition to Moses. The land that the Lord struck down before Israel, that's because there was a war. They were attacked by those two kings, and Jews had to defend themselves. So it kind of, it was orchestrated by God, divine providence. Suddenly, we got all this land. It's a land, it's perfect for livestock. It's fertile land. And your servants have livestock. So it's a perfect shidduch. It's perfect for cattle and for sheep. We got cattle and sheep. It's a match. Okay. So they put in an official request. Let us settle in the Transjordan. They say, if it's pleasing to you, or if you think it's a good idea, we're asking your permission after all. We're not rebelling. We're asking your permission. Let this land be given to your servants as a heritage. So this will be our territory. The land we learned last week was going to be divided, a portion to a territory to each tribe. So this will be ours. This will be our share. We won't own anything in Israel proper, but we're okay with that. We're okay with Transjordan. Do not take us across the Jordan. And those words trigger a reaction in Moses, because he's heard those words before. Right? A few portions back, Parshat Shlach, and we studied it in depth as what was going on there. Moses sent an expedition to scout the land, to collect intelligence as to the nature of the people. Are they powerful? Are they weak? Are they vulnerable? The cities, are they fortified? What are we up against? A military expedition to just not to engage, but to collect data. And he selects 12 capable men, princes of the tribes, and they return and they fail Moses miserably. He asks for a report, and instead they launch a propaganda campaign against the whole prospect of conquering the land. It's impossible. Giants, land devours its inhabitants. They completely demoralize the entire population, well, at least the men. And people are crying. Nobody wants to go in. It's a complete disaster. And of course, it was at that point that God sentences them to spend 40 years in the desert. They spent 40 years in the expedition. As a punishment, 1 year for each day spent scouting the land, bringing back a horrible report. Okay, so he's heard these words before. Don't take us across the Jordan River. And Moshe is very, very concerned. He has serious concerns. Is history repeating itself? That was a disaster. I don't need any more. We're so close. We don't need any more trouble. Concern number one. His first concern is that these two tribes are trying to escape their responsibility. We need, you know, you're part of a nation. Nation goes to war, we all go to war. You can't sit on the side. You can't sit this out. Is this what they're trying to do? Are they trying to abdicate their responsibility? They're not going to send anybody. They're not going to participate in the military campaign. They're going to leave there. And especially as we learn, we'll see a little bit later, but it's mentioned a few places in the Torah, these two tribes were the most fierce warriors of all the 12 tribes. So without them, we wouldn't fare so well by the laws of nature anyway. These are very powerful tribes. So Moshe says to them, sons of Gad and Reuben, what do you mean? He says, shall your brothers go to war and you will stay here? Is that what you want to do? Are you trying to avoid enlisting in the army? Is that what's going on? You guys, you're skipping the draft. So that's obviously a very big concern of Moshe. Although Moses is confident that God will conquer the land, but you know, as we say, believe in God, but pass the ammunition. You do everything that you, by the laws of the nature, you do everything possible so you have an optimum chance of winning. And without Gad and Reuben, chances are reduced. They were the most fierce warriors amongst the Jewish people. So that's concern number one that Moshe has. That he's assuming what they mean, we'll stay back here, you guys go fight it out, we're fine, we don't, you know, we're peace-loving, we don't need that. So he's very concerned. But there's another concern he has, which is also a big concern, because this happened in the past. This is what really caused the disaster with the spies a few weeks ago. He says, quoting the text of the Torah, why do you discourage the children of Israel from crossing over the land? His biggest concern is that when the people hear that the two fiercest tribes have opted out of the war, this will have a terrible effect. It will completely demoralize yet another generation. The old generation that was demoralized with the spies, that was 40 years ago. They're all gone. They died in the desert. Now you got a young generation, free, free of slavery, free of fear of the Gentile. And now, if they see that the two most powerful tribes are hesitant and refusing to participate in the military campaign, it's going to give them pause. Why? What are they scared of? It's going to cause a panic, and you're going to have a repeat of the tragedy of the spies, where all the Jews were demoralized, lost hope, despaired, refused to go into the land. Rashi comments, we're quoting from the commentator Rashi, who always fills in the nuance in the text, and Rashi tells us, what did he mean? Why do you discourage? Says Rashi. You turn aside and dissuade them, their hearts, from crossing the Jordan. For they will think that you are frightened. to cross the Jordan River because of the war, because of the strength of the cities or the people. It's only natural. They will deduce from your hesitance, from your refusal to participate in the war, what is it that we don't know? Maybe this war must be really frightening. The cities must be too powerful. The people. Why else would God and Reuven opt out of the war? And they're the strongest guys we got. If they're scared, what should we say? So a panic will ensue. The people will be demoralized, and history will repeat itself. Continues Moses. Deja vu. This is what your fathers did. Who's their father? Spies. The 12 spies, there was 10 of the 12, but when they returned and they spoke about the impossibility of conquering the land, they demoralized everyone. When I sent them to explore the land, you know, that was fresh in Moses' memory. So for him, history was repeating itself. He said, "Oy vey, I don't want to go there again. I don't want to go through all that again." Continuing 9. So and he reviews the event of the spies. He said, "Look, they went up to the land. They saw the land. The expedition explored the land like I told them, and they came back, brought a terrible report, and discouraged the children of Israel from crossing the land of Israel, crossing into the land. That was the result. It was a disaster. Is that what you guys have in mind? Another disaster?" He wasn't happy, Moshe. Moses was not happy. And he reminded them of how that story ended. God got angry, and God took an oath, and he swore, none of the men over 20 who came out of Egypt will see the land. And he made them wander in the desert for 40 years until that a whole generation died out in the desert. So that's basically what happened. All the men between 20 and 60 over the next 40 years died out. Basically all the men over 20 who were part of the Exodus, part of the Passover story, they died in the desert. They didn't want to go in. They got their wish. They didn't get to go in. Now it was the younger generation who had grown up in the desert, completely new people. Now the women, as it says, was just the men. Women were not involved. So all the women who came out of Egypt entered the land of Israel. Okay? Which is a whole separate story. None of the women participated in any of this nonsense. But the men, they did. So Moshe said, look what happened. It was a disaster, a catastrophe. The people listened, they panicked, and God got upset. 40 years in the desert, the whole generation died, in the, none of them saw the land. Is that what you want? You want a repeat of history? You guys are going to light the match and trigger the same terrible events. Why would you want that, he says. And you have now risen in place of your fathers, says Moses. You're doing exactly what they did. History is repeating itself. It's deja vu. Why would you want to do this, says Moses. Okay, so everybody's clear. Moses' initial response to the proposition of the sons of Reuben and Gad to take up possession in the land of, in the Transjordan area, to take those territories as their possession for their livestock, and not to participate in the military campaign, not to cross the Jordan, not to be part of the war. Moses is not happy, to say the least. And he's got a couple of concerns. One, they're abdicating their responsibility. How can the rest of the tribes go to war and they're not participating? That's not right. Two, and if that does happen, they're going to cause absolute panic, demoralize everybody. So he's got two big issues with their request. So it does not look like Moses is very happy with their request, and therefore, on face value, if he had to reach a conclusion, not very likely that he's going to grant their request, because he doesn't want to repeat of the absolute catastrophe with the story of the spies just a couple of weeks ago. Okay, so now the ball is in the court of the tribe of Gad and Reuben. They respond to Moses' concerns. To some concerns, they respond directly. To others, it's very indirect. In fact, it's hard to understand what exactly they mean by it. And that's what will lead us into a more mystical, Kabbalistic understanding of the story. Because otherwise, the first part of their response makes no sense whatsoever. On the contrary, makes it even worse, as I'll point out in a minute. Okay, so now we pass the microphone to the children of God, children of Reuben, the two tribes who put in the request. So here they begin defending their request. Here's their response. And they make a pledge to fight. 1 second, I skipped a piece. Here we go. The response. Here we go. Response to Moses. So this is the first thing that they say. Now, what on earth this has got to do with the price of fish is hard to understand. But here's the first thing that they say. They say, we will build sheepholds, like stalls for our livestock. They're like sheep. Here on this side of the Jordan, and we'll build cities for our kids. So that's the first thing. So they said, you know, we're going to settle over here. We'll build all kinds of enclosures to contain our livestock, our sheep, our cattle, and then we'll get busy building cities for our kids. So besides what that means, which we'll get to by the end, you see any problem with this? Commentators make a big deal about this. I didn't cite it here, but I'll just tell it to you outside. They point out that this response could have only made Moses more upset. And according to some, it did. Because their priorities are all upside down. What do you mean? You put your cattle before your kids? We'll build sheepfolds for our livestock. And when we're done taking care of the cattle and the sheep, we'll worry about our children. What is that? What kind of priority is that? Don't you put your children first? The Talmud points that out. Commentators point it out. And the same Moses pointed out to them. That doesn't seem to be like a very good way to begin defending their position. What on earth did they mean by this? We'll come back to it. We'll see later on that according to the Kabbalah, the clue to everything that they have in mind, their whole plan, the clue is in these words. What's the clue? We'll see it later. Moving on. Now the next piece seems like a direct response to one of Moses' concerns. The first one. They made a pledge to fight. They said, we will then arm ourselves when we're done with taking care of our kids and our cattle. We will arm ourselves quickly and go before the children of Israel until we have brought them to their place. What are they talking about? We'll go before the children of Israel. So Rashi explains, he adds in a little bit, before the children of Israel, at the head of the troops, we will lead the battle. Not only do we pledge to be part of the war, we're not going to leave our brothers alone on the battlefield. Not only will we join them on the battlefield, we will be in front place. We will take the brunt of the battle. Remember, they were the most powerful warriors we had because they were mighty warriors. As Rashi points out from elsewhere in the Torah, we know this. Moses, at the end of Deuteronomy, blessed all the tribes. And when he describes Gad and Reuven, he says they could take a man down with one blow of a sword. That's how strong they were. One blow, and they could sever a guy from shoulder to shoulder. They were very powerful warriors. So they said, don't worry, we promise, a pledge. We'll be part of the war. Not only that, we'll be in front. Okay, so now Moses sees that these guys are sincere, they're genuine, they're not trying to shirk responsibility, they're not trying to run away from the war, they're not trying to, you know, they're not draft dodgers. So he has a complete change of heart. And they continue. We won't, and they make a pledge, we will not return to our homes until each of the children of Israel has taken possession of their inheritance. In other words, we make out a promise. As long as it takes, and it took 14 years to be precise, 14 years till it was all done, we promise, we take a pledge, we're not going back home to our women and children in the Transjordan till we've finished the job. We're going to follow through till every last Jew of the 10 tribes of Israel has his little piece of land in the Holy Land. We're not going to go back to the other side of the Jordan. Okay, so Moses is happy. One of his big concerns has been taken care of. But what about the other one? He had another concern. When the people hear this, they're going to be demoralized. The suggestion of staying on one side and not crossing the Jordan, they didn't even talk about that. Remember, he said, why would you discourage the people? They never even responded to that. Why not? All they spoke about, oh, we're going to build sheds for our cattle and sheep, and we'll build homes for our kids. A bizarre response. What's that got to do with anything? And somehow that response explains why they want to stay there, not cross the Jordan, and now no one's going to be discouraged. Questions?
Rabbi?
Yes.
When they initially said we're going to build the pens and the homes, wouldn't that take an extraordinarily long time?
Well, that's what they said. The moment you start, we'll arm ourselves quickly, and we're coming.
But they can't go. The rest of the Israelites can't go across till they finish building their pens and cities.
Well, they've got also people who are not military who will stay behind. They can take care of that. Okay, so it's the military, because military men is usually between the age of 30 and 50. So you've got younger people who are beneath military age, the age of conscription, and people who are older. They can handle that. That's why they added the word quickly. Moment you eat us, we will take up arms and we're there. And we will lead you in the battle. And that's exactly what they did. As you see later on in the book of Joshua, that's exactly what they did. So here's the questions. If Moses initially saw their request as an equivalent of the spies shunning the Holy Land, he saw like history repeating itself. So why did he, at the end, agree to their proposal? At the end, Moses completely changed his position. He got all gung-ho. Not only that, he expanded their proposition. He suggested, you know what? How about if one of the half of the tribe of Manasseh joins you? So it ended up that the two tribes, Gad and Reuven, took possession of that side of the Jordan, as well as half of Manasseh, by suggestion of Moses. So he actually expanded their idea. What happened? He's all upset, he's all concerned, he's all worried, the repeat of history, and suddenly he's all gung-ho. And he even expanded on it by adding half of the tribe of Manasseh to the tribes of Gad and Reuben. Two, how did the sons of Reuben and Gad answer Moses' concerns? So the concern about participating in the war and not sitting it out and leaving their brothers through all the fighting, that they took care of. But their very request could panic people and discourage them. They didn't answer that one. The fact that they pledged to participate together with the other tribes in the conquest of the land only answers Moses' first concern. He complained that, you know, you're going to sit out the war. That's not right. But not the other concern, which is seemingly more grave accusation, because we know it's happened already and it could happen again very easily, namely that they are repeating the very same sin of the spies in shunning the land, which had caused that entire generation to die in the desert. So you basically, you could be causing a repeat of a total disaster. If this goes wrong, it goes wrong really bad. And we know how it plays out because it already happened. And the sons of Gad and Reuben don't respond to that at all. They don't even address it. They talk about building pens for their cattle and homes for their kids. That's all they talk about. How does that answer anything? Okay. So on a simple level, it's very hard to make sense of that. Because that complaint in the text seems unanswered. The concern that they'll sit out the war, they took care of it. They pledged not only to participate, but they pledge to actually lead the battle. But the other concern that they're going to demoralize the people, that they didn't answer. So here's the Rebbe's take. It's a mystical take on the whole story, and we'll explain it. So the explanation is to be found, as I told you, the clue is in the first thing they said. What was the very first thing? Their opening statement to Moses: we will build sheepholds, pens for our sheep and cattle, and we will build cities for our young. In those words is a clue to what they were really thinking and how their request was completely different from that of the spies. Where do you see it? We'll get to it slowly. So let's go back to the beginning. If you remember, so Moses is worried that they're repeating the sin of their fathers. The history is repeating itself. The spies shun the land. They're doing the same thing. And just like the spies demoralized the people, caused an absolute disaster, which threatened the whole generation. This could happen again. It's a serious concern. Maybe they will demoralize the new generation, and another generation will end up with another 40 years in the desert. So let's remind ourselves what was the deeper meaning of the story of the spies. What does the Kabbalah teach us? What do the mystics tell us? What was the real reason why those spies were reluctant to make the shift, the transition from living in the desert to now suddenly living in the land of Israel? So let's remind ourselves. Hasidic teaching explains that the sin of the spies, and we study this at length in Parshat Shlach, as resulting from a reluctance to assume the mission of settling the land. Though they knew that the very purpose of creation is to make for God a home, a dwelling here on this earth, in this lowly world, the physical world, they believed themselves incapable of carrying out this mission. I'll review it briefly and read it again. Where do I go? One second. There we go. If you recall, life in the desert, to a great degree, they were not part of this world. They were in another world. Life was supernatural, miraculous. Food doesn't grow in a desert, and they lived there for 40 years. How do they survive? So food is delivered by Amazon.com. Every day, manna falls out of the sky. Bread is provided. You have the well of Miriam. There's water following them around. It's miracles. There's no way to survive by means of nature in a desert, not for 40 years. They're surrounded by clouds, which is that's God's physical manifestation during the 40 years. Fire by night, clouds by day, which essentially was like a force field, protecting them from the hostile elements of the desert, protecting from the climate, from the terrible heat of the day, the cold of the night. So that in a sense, they were not in the physical world at all. And as explained on several occasions, one of the reasons why God did this wasn't a punishment. He gave them a Torah at Sinai. Torah is a divine wisdom. Torah is the way God understands the universe. You don't absorb that overnight. Not even in a week. Not even a year. Minimum 40 years of study to absorb the Torah. So God gave them the Torah at Sinai, but then he needed to put them in a yeshiva so they could absorb the Torah. In order for the Jewish people to become a Torah nation, to assimilate the divine consciousness that was transmitted at Sinai, took time. And so God stuck them in the desert with the greatest teacher of all time, Moses. And he taught him Torah for 40 years till the Torah was absorbed in the people. So the Jewish people and the Torah became one. 40-year process. And in order to free them up to be able to absorb this Torah, to have this, it's like a spiritual commune. They were like in a commune. Everything was taken care of. All they had to do was study. Study divine wisdom for 40 years from the mouth of Moses. So God took care of everything else. I'm taking care of your physical needs. No one will attack you for 40 years. No one will get past the clouds. no snakes, no scorpions. Water, you got water. Food, you got food. Mana tastes like whatever you want, and it nourishes you in a miraculous way. You're good to go. So, in a way, that lifestyle reflected the lifestyle of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the founders of our faith. They chose, because life before Sinai, the world was a very corrupt place. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob generally chose a life of isolation from the rest of the world. What profession did they choose? Patriarchs? Shepherds. Because a shepherd can commune with nature, with God. He's away from the city, away from the corruption. So in a way, the princes of Israel said, look, we're living like the patriarchs in the desert. We're isolated from the outside world. It's just us and God. This is heaven. We're in the Garden of Eden. You'd have to be crazy to give this up. Why should I give up living on a spiritual commune? Everything's taken care of. All I got to do is commune with God. Or choice number two is I get a farm. I get to wake up 4 a.m., plow, till the soil, do that for months, till, you know, way in the evening, come back, harvest, working, grinding, plowing. I mean, what's going to happen to my spirituality? It's gone out the window. I'll have 31 nations attacking me all the time. I'm going to interact with all the non-Jewish world. My spirituality will be gone. That's why the spies said, it's a land that devours its inhabitants. Living on the land, living on earth, an earthly existence devours your spirituality. You got no time to be a Jew anymore. So they said, let's stay in the desert. Sounds like a good plan. What was wrong with their plan? Something fundamentally wrong. It's the opposite of Judaism. Judaism doesn't believe in staying on a mountain in Kathmandu, meditating for 40 years with no one else around you. God created a world for you to inhabit the world, to engage the world, to live on. God wants you to live on earth, to live a natural life like a normal human being, get married, have children, be tempted, have a business, but be honest. And in the context of your humanity, here on earth, make a sanctuary for God, make a home for God. By you living as a holy Jew, you live the same life as the Gentile. Married, eat, drink, sleep, business, but you infuse it all with sanctity, with holiness. Thereby making a home, a dwelling for God here on earth. So what they chose was wrong, because it's not why God created the world. It's terribly wrong. Okay, so now we understand on a deeper level why Moses is again in a panic. He's seeing a deja vu. I have spiritualists again. First, we had the 10 spies 40 years ago who wanted to be spiritual, stay in the world of spirituality and not go down into the physical world, in the normal world. And I got a whole two tribes again. It's even worse. There was only 10 people. I now got two tribes. But that wasn't what they meant. It looked like it, but it couldn't be further from the truth. What was the truth? So we got to take a little mystical journey. Let me explain. Okay, let's not close it. Oh. Okay, so the spies, we said, they said, look, we can't handle this mission. We want to stay in the desert. We don't want to go live in the land. It's a land that consumes its settlers. If we give up the spiritual life, we will lose our souls in the land of Israel. The spies cried on their return from their survey of the land, how could they be sure that once they got involved, they involved themselves with the physical world, with the land, that they would not be overwhelmed by the physicality of living on the land, and that would destroy their souls. How could they know whether they would indeed exploit all of the lofty potential and not instead sink into the morass of the material life? Because it can go either way. Either you can make a home for God in the world, or you become part of the world and you lose your soul. And they didn't want to take the risk. But of course, they were wrong, because that's exactly what God wants. A repeat of history. Two, when the people of Reuben and Gad came forward with their request, Moshe thought that he was again faced with a refusal by a group of spiritualists, holy guys, shunning the divinely ordained mission to develop the physical world. Oh, I've seen this before. But now it's worse. I got two whole tribes, not 10 men. So the Rebbe explains. The sons of God and Reuben explained themselves. We're not falling for the mistake of the spies. We're not refusing, we're not scared to enter the physical world. On the contrary. And we'll explain in a second. The truth, however, was not that they feared the dread of the material that motivated, that was motivating the sons of God and Reuven to remain on the other side of the Jordan. On the contrary, they wanted to settle these lands to build cities and ranches to raise their sheep and their cattle on it, on the pastures. Their plea, do not take us across the Jordan, did not express a reluctance to seek out the potential for holiness that's contained in the physical world, in the land of Israel, but an attraction to even more remote and loftier, and thus even loftier sparks of godliness. Let me explain what that means. Let's read something from the Baal Shem Tov, and I'll explain what's going on here. Well, let me explain it like this. One second. There we go. Okay. So we're going to read it from the Baal Shem Tov in a moment. That we know that God wants us to make a home for Him here on earth. That's why Judaism is earth-oriented. It's physical-oriented. We don't reject the physical, the body. We don't reject marriage, God forbid. Abstinence is not the highest form of serving God, but being engaged in the world, eating, drinking, enjoying life, being married, having a business. That's what God wants. And the Kabbalists explained to us an interesting concept, and we'll read it inside in a moment, that in order for everything to exist, a tree, a mountain, an apple, anything, it has to have a little presence of God in it. And that little presence of God is what grants that physical object existence. That's kind of what it means when it says God spoke 10 times in the beginning of Genesis. He spoke, and with those words he created the universe. And we call that life force, that divine energy, which flows hidden inside every physical object, we call it in the language of Kabbalah a spark of God, or a holy spark. It's a divine energy. It gives this, it makes the tree exist. It makes the tree grow. Existence and vitality. And it's in everything that exists. And what happens is, if a Jew cuts down a tree and he turns the tree into an ark to hold the Torah, what happens is he releases the divine spark contained in that tree. It returns to God and releases a tremendous energy of goodness and holiness and light in the universe. And you, essentially, a Jew has elevated the tree, turning the world into a home for God. That's what the Jews did with the tabernacle. They took raw materials and transformed them into something holy, thus releasing the sparks of God. And so the Kabbalists explain to us that wherever you go as a Jew, you encounter the physical world. You eat a dinner, you buy a coat, you buy a car, you buy a house. There are sparks of God in everything. And there are sparks of God that belong to your soul. And it's your mission, that's why you're sent to earth, to use those physical objects in the service of God, to elevate them. And they in turn elevate you. And that's why the spies were so fundamentally wrong, because God wants us to inhabit the physical earth, not to remain isolated in a spiritual desert. For there are sparks of God contained in the land, in everything, and they have to be released, and they can be released only by us living on the land and engaged in a physical, mundane, normal life here on earth. So here's how it works. And we're going to read this a little bit inside. The Kabbalists explain. It's a big subject. I'll just give you the Reader's Digest version. That these sparks of God, the higher they are, they come from a very holy place. Where they come from is another class for another time, how God generated these sparks and caused them to fall into our world and to be embedded in the physical. But the Kabbalah explains that the loftier, the more sublime the spark of God, the greater the divine energy, the lower it falls. Kabbalah uses a metaphor. Imagine a tall, tall building, a wall. So the higher up on the wall you go, when a brick from the top of the wall falls down, it falls furthest away from the wall. If it falls halfway from the wall, halfway down, it doesn't fall as far. So the sparks of God that fell, they fell deliberately by God, he placed them here, into the physical world, the further they fall, the higher the spark. So here's what the B'nai God, B'nai Reuven said. Look, you just told us that we have a mission. We got to go into the land. We got to occupy the land because there are sparks of God which we Jewish people must release the divine energy, the potential to make this home a dwelling for God on earth. By that logic, where would the sparks of God be greater? In the Holy Land or outside of the Holy Land? So the Kabbalah explains Yes, there are sparks of God in the Holy Land, but the sparks of God outside of the Holy Land are even greater. Because that's why they fall in the outside of the land of Israel, not in a holy place. The greater the sparks, the further they fall. This is what the Talmud says, that we went into exile to collect the sparks. Because the sparks of God found in exile, in Ventura, in Oxnard, are even holier and loftier and more sublime than the sparks of God in Jerusalem. So the B'nai God, B'nai Reuven said, look, Moses, you just told us that our mission is to live on the earth and to free the sparks of God. Well, by that logic, the sparks of God on this side of the Jordan, they are higher. We want to go for a bigger challenge. Keep us here in the land, the other side of the Jordan, and we want to have access with which we want to have the challenge of releasing the higher sparks, which are so high they can't even fall in the land of Israel, in the Holy Land. Let's have a look inside. Let me read it inside. Okay. After all, the land west of the Jordan, though it's material, was the Holy Land, and where even the most mundane pursuits are found attached with a spiritual glow outside of the, that's in the land of Israel. Outside of the Holy Land, however, the physical world is on a lower level than in the land of Israel and must contain sparks of God, divine sparks, that derive from an even higher source. The tribes of Reuben and Gad were convinced that their mission in this life, in this world, was therefore to pursue, to extract, and to elevate the sparks of God inherent in this more in the more spirituality, more spiritually distant corner of the world of creation. In other words, our brothers, the 10 tribes, they'll deal with the Holy Land where the sparks of God are not that high. But we feel we're capable of a higher challenge. We can even handle the sparks of God that fell even lower. How do we know they fell lower? They're outside of the Holy Land. They're in the land of the non-Jews. There the sparks of God fell even lower. So we're ready to take the bigger challenge. When they said to Moses, we will build the sheds for our cattle and cities for the children, Moses understood that what they were in fact seeking was not to escape from the land, not to escape from the world, but an opportunity to make a home for God in even the lowest areas, the lowest domain, even in the territories that lay beyond the borders of the most sacred, the land of Israel, the lands as defined by Israel, by the presence of God in the land of Israel. Because what they're saying essentially is, we feel that we can handle a bigger challenge. Not just elevate the sparks of God in a holy land, because it's one thing to be Jewish in a holy land. It's easier. It's more of a challenge to be a Jew outside of the Holy Land. We feel that we're ready and prepared for a greater challenge, to be Jewish even outside of the Holy Land. And and by default, therefore, as well, to release, to extract the sparks of God contained in the physical world that have fallen even lower because they're contained outside of the Holy Land. We can handle even that. We're confident we can do that.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So why should we make aliyah if the sparks are higher outside of Eretz Yisrael?
Well, for the fact remains, for the most part, Jewish people lived where? Throughout our Jewish history. Where did God direct us for the most part? 90% of Jewish history played out where? In exile. As the Talmud says, we were set into exile for all the converts. And the Kabbalists explain, what does it mean, converts? We went to exile converts? Yes, for the sparks of God. For the sparks of God contained in exile are much greater. Even in the story of the Torah, where do they spend most of their time? In the first five books, which land were they in? Egypt.
Egypt.
For 400 years. When they left Egypt, what does it say? They emptied out the land like a fishnet without fish. Says the Kabbalah, they emptied out Egypt of all the sparks of God. And once they had finished the job, that's why they had to leave. In fact, the Kabbalists explain the deeper reason behind, the mystical reason behind Jewish expulsion from country to country. We come to a land, we use its natural resources to build synagogues to serve God. We elevate that land and its natural resources and the sparks of God embedded in the land. And once we've released all the divine potential, we no longer have a mission in that land. And that's why we get thrown out. Time to move on to the next country. That's why the Torah says that a Jew is prohibited to return to live in which land? Egypt. Because it's empty. The Jew has no business being there. Because generally speaking, all the sparks of God were released by the Jewish people living there for those 210 years. So the B'nai Gad B'nai Reuben were mighty warriors spiritually. That we feel we can handle the challenge of even bringing outside of the Holy Land to God. Now, eventually, all the Jewish people would do that. But here's how it works. Just to explain a little bit more. Before the Jews went into the land of Israel, where did God keep them for 40 years? He kept them locked up in the desert, in a spiritual commune. That was boot camp. In order to be able to go into the land and not allow the physical world to drag you down, to have the strength, the inner strength, to rise above and to harness the physical world, to turn it in, to transform it into something holy, you need to have some time when you're outside of the world, above it. So God kept them 40 years in the desert where they were above the world. That was boot camp. To prepare them for the battlefield, which was living on the land. Now, the same thing is true of the Jewish people. Us living in the Holy Land was boot camp for the time when we would be booted out of the Holy Land and we would live in the land of the Gentiles. Eventually, all the Jewish people would be doing what the tribes of Gad and Reuben were suggesting in this week's Torah portion. For the most part of our history, we would be like the children of Gad and Reuben, living in the land of the non-Jew. And and using the resources, natural resources, to serve God despite everything, to make every corner of this earth a holy place to God, to find, search, and extract every spark of God anywhere on this earth. So the training for the Jews in Israel was the desert. The training for the Jews in Jewish history, which for the most part was exile, outside, was living in Israel. And that's why the children of Gad and Reuben said, we will participate in the conquest of the Holy Land. In other words, we will participate in the job of extracting the sparks of God, even in the Holy Land. And when we're done with you together, then we will have the strength to go back to Transjordan and transform the land of the non-Jews. If that's the case, says Moses, sounds like a plan. You're not overconfident. You understand that you need extra strength to live in the land of the non-Jews, outside of the Holy Land. You need more spiritual strength, not less. But if you will join us in the conquest, in searching and releasing the sparks of God in the Holy Land, in the land of Israel, first, and when that campaign is done, then you will have the strength to go back to Transjordan outside of the Holy Land and continue the work there, which is a harder job. It's a bigger challenge. And in a sense, all of us, the Jewish people, went through the same thing as the sons of Gad and Reuben. We lived in the land of Israel for hundreds of years, and we were trained to find God, sparks of God, in a holy land. Now God said, you did that for 400 years, now find sparks of God in an unholy land. I'm throwing you to the Gentiles. I send you to Babylon, to Europe, to Spain, all over the world. And bring me the sparks of God all over the world. Let's finish this up. Says the Holy Baal Shem Tov. Listen to the words of Israel Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. He wrote, this is something actually he said about the sparks of holiness. That your soul, the mission of your soul, each and every one of us, is to find the sparks that belong to our soul. It is an important principle, says the Holy Baal Shem Tov, that when you wear clothes, you eat food, or you make use of anything in the physical world, you derive benefit from the vital force inherent in that object, which is the presence of God. It's the word of God, which he spoke, and Baruch Sha'ama V'Hoy Olam, he spoke and everything came into existence. And it's the word of God that remains in that physical object, which is like the battery. But it doesn't just give life, it gives existence. If that presence of God withdraws, it doesn't die, it ceases to exist. So says the Baal Shem Tov, whenever you use an object, what you're really using is the divine energy contained in that object. The object could not exist without that spiritual component. That divine energy gives it existence, gives it vitality, and it contains holy sparks. In Hebrew, nitzotzot, that relate to the very root of your soul. Why did you pick the apple on the tray? There were 50 delicious apples on the tray, but you pick one apple. Oh, I like the apple. No, says Baal Shem Tov. The spark of God in that apple belongs directly to your soul. The sparks of God contained in the wood of the house that you bought, that you decided you liked it because of the kitchen. No. Those sparks belong to your very soul and not to anybody else's. And that's why you chose that house. Why you choose that job. Why you choose whatever it is that you choose. I heard, says the Baal Shem Tov, I heard, that means he heard from Elijah the prophet. That was his teacher. I heard that this is the reason why a particular thing is loved by some people and disliked by other people who love something else. When you love it because the spark of God in that object belongs to your soul, to the root of your soul. That's why you like it. Someone else doesn't like it. When using something or eating food, therefore, even if you did so for your bodily needs, you rectify these sparks, you release them, you send them back to God. They are rectified by virtue of you using the strength, the energy added to your body by the clothes, by the food, or whatever it is, or other things. And you use that to serve God, right? Thus, it may happen that when you complete the rectification of all those sparks in that object which relate to the root of your soul, because those sparks belong uniquely to your, they got your name on it. God takes it away from you and gives it to someone else because its remaining sparks relate to that other person. And as I said, this is why the Kabbalists explain, this is the secret, the mystery of the expulsion of the Jewish people. They were expelled from Spain because they were done with Spain. Like they were done with Egypt. They had emptied out Egypt, says the verse. Vayenatzu es Mitzrayim, says the Zohar. They took out 248 sparks of God. When they emptied the sparks from Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella kicked us out. And so this is the mystery, the concept of the sparks of God, which is the very life energy that gives existence to everything in the universe. And there are sparks in general, and there are sparks specifically that have our name on it. Which is why one person ends up in Chicago and someone else ends up in Oxnard or Ventura. Because there are sparks of God in Chicago which he has to release. There are sparks of God that we have to release. And hence the children of God and Reuben, not only were they not falling for the same mistake of the spies, on the contrary, they wanted not just to engage the world, but even the Gentile world. They were ready for a bigger challenge. And in a sense, their story is our story, because when you think about it, 90% of Jewish history, although there was always a Jewish presence in the land of Israel, but where did we live? The bulk of our people, the bulk of the Jewish population and world Jewry, where did we live for the most part, most of Jewish history? On the other side of the Jordan, in the land of the Gentiles, to bring the loftiest sparks, the most difficult sparks, the those that have fallen the lowest and the furthest down. Any questions? Shalom.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Could that mean that the reason why the Rebbe never went to Israel?
No, because that. Because the Rebbe sent, he had representatives in every city. So there were plenty of sparks to elevate there. The Rebbe's personally not going, it's a separate story. Clear?
For another time.
Is that no questions?
Well, Rabbi, I have a question in terms of...
Sure.
Why did the two tribes who stayed on the other side of the Jordan, why did they refer to themselves as separate from the children of Israel? Because at least in the text there, it seems like they said, we're going to help out the children of Israel, but it seems like they would also be children of Israel. And I just...
It's correct. It's a good question. I don't think they meant to separate themselves, but they're just speaking generically, but you are 100% correct, because they are also children of Israel. And they're just making it very, very clear that, on the contrary, even though we are choosing to live physically apart, but morally, mentally, spiritually, nationally, and in spirit, we are also children of Israel. And to prove that point, not only are we going to pledge to participate, which goes without saying, we never, God forbid, suggested, we never meant that, furthest from our minds, but to show you to what extent we're children of Israel and we're part of our brothers. Remember, they called them our brothers. We will lead the battle. And they're volunteering to do that. And there was a lot of fighting. And they kept their word. At every battle, the sons of God, sons of Reuben, and they were, like I said, the fiercest warriors we had, they were out in front. But sometimes the Torah uses that poetic language, you know, the children of Israel.
Didn't they always also frame the argument that they would be, as it were, a forward defensive perimeter for Israel itself? They occupy the transfer.
You don't see him there anywhere proposing that. The fact is that the real threats were the Amorites and Bashan. The Midian, they were taken out already. So were the Moabites. And then later on, the Pasha, the Midianites. So all those threats were gone. Most of the threats through Jewish history came from within. The Philistines, they were a real problem later on, all the way through to times of King David. And then later on, the bigger threats came from afar. You know, big empires, Assyria, Babylon, Rome. That's a fascinating story anyway. And the concept of the sparks of God is a fascinating concept, because like the Baal Shem Tov says, he says when you're, just to use the example of the apple again, you see an apple, and one particular apple takes your fancy. And or the very fact that suddenly you're hungry, you have an appetite for an apple, says the Baal Shem Tov, that's your soul communicating to your body through your animal soul that there's a spark in there that belongs to you. There's a verse in Psalms that says that your soul is reacting to the food. Nafshem behem titataf. Says Baal Shem Tov, your soul is reacting to the spark of God in the apple. But you know, you're a human being. You don't respond to soul, so the soul speaks to the animal soul, which speaks to the body, which speaks to the gut. I'm hungry for an apple. So you think you're hungry for an apple, and you are hungry for an apple. But the real reason is that there's a spark of God, divine energy there. But in order to release it, you got to make a bracha. You got to eat it, make a blessing, eat it mindfully, eat it for a higher purpose. And it's got to be a kosher apple, which you can't really have a non-kosher apple. In Israel, you could. But, you know, the food's got to be kosher. But that's the chemistry, the divine chemistry, which the Baal Shem Tov revealed to us that takes place between the soul and the body when it comes to eating food?
The food that does not contain a spark of God is treif.
Oh, it has a spark, but a spark that is so buried that you can't release it.
It's not your spark.
It's also not your, it can be, if it's kosher, it might not be yours. So you're not attracted to it. If it's forbidden by the Torah, if it's non-kosher food, it too has a spark. Otherwise it couldn't exist. But it's so buried, as we learned last night, it's so buried that you can't see it. And the spark of God cannot be released. Not today anyway. And therefore, the only thing a Jew can do is reject it. If he takes a non-kosher challah, he can make 100 blessings, but he can't release the spark of God. It's imprisoned there. Only if that challah is kosher. In Hebrew, and I'll conclude with this, the word for prohibited to be eaten or permitted to be eaten is the same words for tied down or released. So when the Torah says it's prohibited, it means it's tied down to the unholy and you can't release it. It's imprisoned. And when you say it's kosher, it's mutar, it's untied, it's freed of to soar. You can elevate it. So an apple that's kosher, you could elevate it if it's got your spark, if you're attracted to it. If not, someone else will eat it. So that's the chemistry, the mystery of the chemistry, divine chemistry behind eating as revealed to us by the Holy Baal Shem Tov. On that note, I wish everybody a wonderful, wonderful week and a wonderful Shabbos, God willing.